listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief. This is Jinan Ra'uf. We are continuing our Muslimish Freethinkers podcast. We're continuing to talk about prayer with Nora Imbabi, Wissam Sharafuddin, and Zarar Shahzad. I'm your host, Jinan Ra'uf, and we will be talking a little bit more detail about the ritual of purification before prayer. That is, you have to do something called the wudu, where you have to kind of wash yourself before you enter into a state of spiritual purity. And so we're going to start with Wissam talking to us about the challenges of doing the wudu five times a day for the ritual prayer. Wissam?
Can I just interject and ask, are we in this session now, we're going to be more casual? Is that what we're doing?
Yes, that would be great.
Well, I've been casual. I've been casual, Zarar. I don't know about you.
No, but I mean, Jinan won't be hosting this session. We'll be each of us interjecting as we have questions. Yeah, we're recording.
Yes, well,
that makes it casual.
Well, that makes it casual, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean... Well, first of all, I want to say that this is something very important as Muslimish. Some of us, I mean, it's very interesting here. The four of us have a completely different experience with prayer. Or prayer was to a certain degree integrated into their lives differently. So I would think I am on the end of the spectrum in terms of how much prayer is integrated or was integrated in my life, to the extent that, you know, once you become a male who is yani baligh, what do you call it, who, you know, reaches the age of puberty, of adolescence, then prayer becomes compulsory on you. It's obligatory on you. And if you miss a prayer, then making up the prayer is also obligatory. And there is periods of my adolescence where I missed prayer. And then at a certain point when I was very religious, I had to make up these prayers. So I had to do an estimation. And I estimated like they're between 1 year to 2 years. And then the scholar told me, then just do it 2 years and make up 2 years of prayers. So I started making up 2 years of prayer, and it took me a few years to make them up in addition to the daily prayer.
Wait, how would that work? How would you make it up?
You just make it up. You just make up. So you pray Fajr, Dhuhr, Asr, Maghrib.
But like every time you do Fajr, you would do more rak'ahs, or would you do a certain time of day?
Some people do it this way. I used to do it like at night. So instead of praying Salat al-Layl, which is Salat al-Layl, it's like night prayer. It's a recommended prayer. It's recommended at the last third of the night, so like before Fajr. But you can pray it any time after Isha. And it's 11 rak'ah, you know. But so I used to pray it at night to get like the award of the night prayer. At the same time, I'm making up prayer. And once I finished making up all these prayers, I started praying Salat al-Layl. And it was one of my favorites. So I was going to reflect on that maybe later on in this episode about how positive experience was that for me.
Well, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that you're making up the prayer because you're given award. So this is something that's very socially prestigious for you to be doing all of these prayers?
No, awards from God.
Oh, I see, rewards. Oh, you said award, rewards.
Okay. Rewards.
What more could he want, Mike?
Yes.
But I mean, there is, but in the sense of, reward in the sense of also when you are perceived socially and communally to be doing this, it does raise your status.
Yeah, but if you don't want, but as far as me, because again, this is a subjective discussion, As far as me personally, I did not want anyone to know about it because it is between me and God. And Islamically, it decreases from the reward if others know about it. You know, the more.
So this was more of a personal thing you're saying, Wissam, that you were doing this because you wanted to be close to God and you wanted to be rewarded for your prayers.
Well, making up my prayers was obligatory. It was not up to me, according to the school of thought that I was following. Some schools of thought, they just do like forgiveness. If it's long periods of time, they say you just do tawbah for it. You don't have to make it up. Most people, though, they have to make it up, especially in the Shia school of thought. Extent that every person, they put it in their will that, you know, I have like 10 years that I have to make up. And then they dedicate part of his money to pay someone who prays for him these prayers. And there are people dedicated, especially in Iran, to make up prayers for people who die.
There's a lot of very complex calculations here. How many years, yes. How many
they
prayers?
It's just estimates.
Okay.
And they do it and they, you know, it's like an industry by itself. But anyway, so my experience with prayer, I had a very positive experience with prayer. Now, positive from a like spiritual, from an emotional point of view. It was very meditative. It was more of a Sufi experience, which is what prayer is designed to be. It's designed to be, like Zirar said, very meditative. If you read any book about the spiritual meanings of the prayer, of the different harakat, the different movements in the prayer and the sayings, it's kind of spiritualized through Islamic scholars. They have created spiritual meanings for each movement, and with the understanding and contemplation during these movements, and there is a very strong Islamic rhetoric and encouragement to have that meditative state, to the extent that they tell you, you know, the prayer without this meditative state is meaningless.
Right.
There's a very strong encouragement to be focused, to be meditative, to not to think about anything else. But the difference between it and meditation, which is a very, very important point, is that it is outward. It's not inwardly.
What do you mean?
You forget yourself. You get annihilated. You are disappearing. And all your thoughts are going to God, and you're disappearing like a grain of sand or like a grain of salt.
So it's kind of like the idea of fanat, that you're becoming like an emptier vessel so that you can receive the divine, kind of a thing.
Exactly. And that's some of the spiritual meanings of the sujood, the last be where, you know, where you fall down to the ground and you're done, you're gone. You're completely melted into in the form of worship to God. So Sufism comes from these meanings, right? But the difference between it and Eastern religion, like Buddhism and Hinduism and meditation, is that meditation is inwardly.
Right.
While prayer is outwardly, you're forgetting yourself and you're focusing on an entity that's outside of you.
Nora had a very different experience. She talked to me about how she found it sometimes difficult to focus and to block out the outside world. Can you talk about that, Nora?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think theoretically I was taught Islam not to the same degree that Wissam was just sharing, but in a similar degree that in a sense you are forgetting about where you are. You are not where you are physically. Your mind is completely focused. You're aspiring to make your mind completely focused on another entity. And that you're supposed to like forget about everything going on around you, to the degree that, you know, if someone was dying next to you, or if something was being taken away, or if there was a fire raging around you, that you were so focused on God and on this ritual that you were not sort of distracted. Janan, I did find that very unrealistic. And I was taught this story when I was a child that someone was praying while his son was being taken away from him and thrown into a well by Shaitan. And the father never broke his prayer. And when he was done, he went to go check on his son, and his son was pulled out of the well with an apple in his mouth, and that he was completely fine, and only because the father never broke his prayer. So to me, this is this was scary to me as a child because I thought, well, I don't know that I can dedicate that amount, that level of focus, especially because you're, as a child, my mind was all over the place. And even as an adult, but especially as a child. And I felt that this was something unreasonable was being asked of me. And yet at the same time, it was sort of, a good aspiration. Like it was mental, practice for me every time I went to pray for me to be, deliberately and consciously focusing on, leaving some things behind and not thinking about worldly or, social matters or anything that was going on and trying to focus.
Did it help you in certain ways? Did it help you become, you know, was it a kind of a mental discipline for you that helped you focus in school, for example? Were there positive consequences from the
prayer? I would
need
to do scientific studies on myself to know that, but I don't actually know if it helped me.
What about you, Zarar?
Does the prayer help, you're saying?
Yeah, do you feel that it helped you in general become more focused mentally?
Yeah, I think it definitely helps with the focus. Although I feel like it's not, maybe, you know, what Sam was talking about, the meditative thing, and maybe neurosis. So the prayer to me doesn't seem, I don't know what the word is. So when you meditate, there's like clear, like outcomes. So you meditate on breathing, and it feels easier in some ways to, if you focus on your breath, to know whether you're benefiting or not. Whereas sometimes I find with prayer, at least for me, it can be distracting because you have to do so many different things. And I don't know what Wissam might say about that, like how those different phases might put you out of the zone.
I agree with you. I mean, the outward, the meditation and prayer, some people mix them up. Some people say, yeah, we do meditation because we do prayer. But the person who practices both knows the difference. If you do prayer, it's hard to do meditation. And if you're doing meditation, you're not doing prayer for sure. So there is a difference between them. I mean, there are moments of meditation. Like if you're doing sujood, you know that a long silence in prayer is invalidates prayer.
Really?
So if you stay in silence for a long period of time, it invalidates your prayer. You have to redo it. If you cry in your prayer excessively, it invalidates the prayer. It's very mechanical, and that's why it's easy for Muslims to practice it. And it's, you know, you do it and you feel good. It's mechanical. If prayer was that you have to get into an internal peace and, you know, like meditation goals are, prayer would be a very hard thing that very few Muslims would accomplish. But it being mechanical just makes it an easy thing, and people feel like it's a check mark, you know, it's a feel-good thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I ended up finding. I found like it's in the evenings especially, my mind is too gone, and so it seems it's easier to do prayer. And it is a check mark. I'm like, okay, I did this. And it is a moment where you stop and you reflect, and so it's nice to have that moment. And it's structured in a very easy way. So, and then yeah, you feel better about yourself for having done something.
You feel better also because you've done something that pleases God. I mean, is there a sense of I have a duty and I did it and now I'm finished with it, like it's off my back kind of a thing?
Are you asking me if that's how I feel?
I'm asking everybody.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Muslims do feel a high level of reward after accomplishing a prayer. There is nothing. There's a saying, it says that there is no amount of salat mustahabba, recommended prayer, voluntary prayers. There is no amount of voluntary prayers that you can perform that makes up the reward of one obligatory prayer.
Wow. So it's a feeling of approval. You've done something that you're supposed to do. It's going to be rewarded. It's a pillar of the religion. It's very important. So there's a sense of, I have fulfilled my duty and I feel good about it. The sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, I think that's definitely there. Can I? There's one thing I wanted to note. Just Sam was talking about the differences between meditation and prayer, but there are certain meditative practices that are more outward, right? There's like loving kindness meditation. I'm blanking on some other ones where you do sort of direct your attention outward, or you remove the divide between yourself and the outside world.
Right.
So in a funny way, you also obliterate the self, but it's in this different way where you eliminate the eliminate the existence that there is a self, right? I don't know if anyone had thoughts on
it. Can you be more specific, Zarar? Can you give us an example of that?
Well, of the loving kindness, though, usually in loving kindness meditation, it goes through phases. So you start out with someone, you're like, I wish them no harm. I wish them, no external or internal dangers that they might face. And you start by focusing on someone you love. And then you go to someone who's neutral, and you also focus this sort of loving kindness. There's usually a mantra that you repeat. And then you end up with someone you like absolutely hate and don't want any good to come of them, like an arch nemesis. I have an arch nemesis. And so then you like sort of wish these things onto them. And so that's an interesting form of meditation where it's a bit different than what Sam was saying. So it's not actually focused inward in a way, it's focused outward, and you are focusing a lot on, but it's not focused on God here, it's focused on people.
But the common thing you're saying is the obliteration of the ego.
Yeah, I guess you're right. You said it, that's a good phrase, yeah. It's like sort of trying to take away the ego. So that's one way to do it with loving kindness. In some ways, breathing meditation does that too. You're supposed to let go of your ego and let go of yourself and realize there is no self as you do this, as you have these thoughts, you realize, sorry, I'll back up here. So for people who don't know, for certain types of breathing meditation, you focus on your breath, and then different thoughts might sort of pop up in your head. And what you're supposed to do is not get attached to them and just sort of let them go.
Right.
And in doing that, you're also supposed to realize that like there's sort of no self. Like you think these thoughts are generated by yourself, but they're actually not. They're generated by different parts of you that are just sort of like taking hold of your consciousness.
Very interesting. Nora,
and that's very similar to prayer.
In the sense of we're trying to get rid of yourself or your ego, right?
Right. Even the surah that is recited, that is obligatory to recite in the first two units of the prayer, which is Al-Fatiha, which is the opening surah, the chapter, which is it's about gratitude, right?
Oh, interesting.
So it is a gratitude saying, and then there is a praise in the sayings, a mantra of praise in the sujood and ruku'ah. And then at the end, you're having gratitude to the Prophet, right?
Uh-huh.
And we're learning now that one of the things that makes people happier is
Richard.
The expression, also the expression of gratitude.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That one of the things that makes people feel good, like if you know, we're always given advice that one of the practices to make yourself happier and more content is during your day to express or remember two things that you are grateful for, and that actually makes us feel better as human beings.
Yes, and that makes prayer a positive experience. And especially if it's done with that intention, if it's done with mindfulness, then it becomes a positive force in a society, and it becomes a positive practice in a society.
But I think, Nora, you had said something really interesting to me about how beyond a certain point that the prayer became meaningless to you, that you felt you were doing it to get your dad off your back. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because they've been talking about sort of the positive experience of prayer, but there's also the element of social pressure. So if you could talk about that a little bit.
I'll just mention that I don't know if this was just my own experience, but sometimes I felt like the need to say Surah Al-Fatiha made it so that if I didn't say it, I was putting myself in danger of like straying off the path. I don't know if anyone else relates to this, Wissam or Zarar, that like the need to ask God to keep you on the right path meant that staying on the path wasn't necessarily always your choice. Like I felt a loss of agency because I kept asking for someone else to keep me, you know, keep me in the right way of things. I don't know if anyone else relates to that.
My comment on Surah Al-Fatiha is not the same as yours. My comment on it, or sort of my reservations about it, is that it is kind of judgmental. So, صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين, which is translated as to mean the Jews and the Christians, right? Those who you are angry upon, which are the Jews, and those who went astray, which are the Christians. So it's kind of a judgmental, like, you know, not only you're asking him to guide you, but you're also asking him not to make you like those people, which is a very judgmental attitude. So you're attacking some people in this surah.
Could you explain to us, to the audience, please, Wissam, when the Fatiha, how the Fatiha fits into the prayer? Is it the opening recitation in every ritualized prayer?
Yeah, so prayers are made of units called rak'ah. Each unit is made of about five different types of actions. And each prayer, the five prayers, have different number of rak'ahs, so different number of units. And every unit starts with the recitation of Al-Fatiha, which is chapter 1 of the Quran.
Okay.
And it's kind of a little prayer of gratitude and praise and judgment.
And supplication that God will keep us on the right path.
Right. The path of those who are not, did not get angry upon, which is interpreted as the Jews, and those who have not gone astray, which is interpreted Islamically as the Christians. Well, some interpreters, you know, some scholars might have different opinions, but that's the mainstream Islam.
And that's what Noura is saying, something very interesting, is she felt that this constant supplication that God would keep her on the right path made her feel like she was losing agency. That part of the discomfort for her was that her ego was actually disappearing too much, that there was a higher being that she depended on, in a sense, to keep her on the right path. I mean, Zarar, how did you feel about the Fatiha?
Well, I mean, I guess growing up, because I don't speak Arabic, it didn't, I mean, I knew the meaning, actually, growing up, but not the way that Wissam is describing it. But so growing up, it didn't have a big meaning, except we just repeated it all the time in the prayer. As I'm older and now I pray, it's more like a mantra, again, because it's lost its meaning. So maybe that was the issue that both of them are stating, is that they had problems with what it meant. And I guess I sort of almost obliviously pray to it. The last point that I wanted to make, though, was that I had been thinking about this, like, because as I pray it, I'm like, okay, well, when you pray to Allah, like, what do you mean by it? And so I think for me to be able to do the prayer, it meant that I had to really understand that a little bit better. And so I think for a lot of people, Allah is more like, someone said, it's like Santa Claus, you know, it comes and gives you, like, good things or a coal if you're bad or something like that, right? And so for me, Allah seemed like it was a word that Muhammad or they at the back then used to describe something that was sort of like limitless. I think of Allah much like the Brahman. It's like this ultimate reality, this thing that connects everything else. It's this thing that gives the world meaning and order. And so that's what I think. I guess that sounds funny in Muslimish, because a lot of people don't think about that in Muslimish. But for me, it's a very spiritual word, and it's the word that represents something that I think is real. There's like there's really order and meaning in the world, and Allah encompasses all of it.
So it's more of order and meaning rather than a divine being that's going to punish or reward you. It's connecting you to some higher reality, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's some higher reality. And maybe it's closer to maybe the Eastern faiths, like the way the Brahmin is described. Or if you're familiar with the Chinese, they have Wu Wei, this force in the universe and stuff. So this, and almost maybe also more like science in some ways then. Because in science, there are forces that, yeah, there's like the cosmos. But also from the cosmos, there are forces that like, drive the reason the cosmos are one way or the other. Sorry, I don't want to hijack this conversation, but can I make an aside on that idea of like the order of the universe? So the one way I think a lot of people, when they think of Allah or when they pray, they think of the world more as like, if you have it, this is a famous story. I forget, some Jewish theologian used to say it. Like if you drop an ink blot, right? You have a bottle full of ink and you drop it on a paper and then imagine it ends up being something from Shakespeare. And then people are like, that's the universe. That's why there's intelligent design. That's why like Allah made everything. But it's funny because that's like, it's actually more amazing how it actually works. It's not like that at all. In fact, the world builds itself. So there are forces and properties that the universe begins with just hydrogen. And then somehow there are ways that it does it. It builds up the periodic table that we see. The universe builds itself up. And so, yeah, I feel like those things to me are sort of amazing that the universe built, like iron didn't exist at the beginning of the universe. And so later we get it just because of the way the universe builds itself. And so I think, I don't know, sorry, I made a tangent, but hopefully you can see by this distinction, by the way people normally view it as like, oh, an ink blot makes Shakespeare. That's the way the world is. And it's divine versus the way that I'm describing it, where it's like a more scientific way, but they're the forces of the universe that somehow like amazingly make order and meaning and make us. So I guess that's what it means to me.
And that's what the experience of prayer connects you to, if I'm understanding correctly?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I guess I don't do the black hole thing as much, but if I orient myself to the black hole, then I really think about like this object that binds everything that's black and hidden. So sometimes it can.
I like that a lot. So I'm going to I was just going to say, like, I just feel like, I know we're going off on a tangent, but I feel like this is what it could look like, you know, not post-religion, but, you know, without the same traditional and conventional ways of practicing in a religion, this is how we could feel tied to everything around us. I'm sorry to sound hippy dippy.
So do you think that with people in Muslimish, that the prayer could evolve into something different, that there are certain things that we can take from that, and that there will be forms of meditation that will emerge from that? Is that what you're looking forward to, Nora? Or at least the possibility
maybe,
of that happening?
I mean, I differ slightly from like I have a different feeling about mantras, or maybe I just don't know enough about mantras, but to me, like repetition and ritual has its benefits, but also stands out as extremely arbitrary, like the number of times, and maybe even we could spend a little time talking about wudu, and I would be curious to hear about Wissam's experience with that. But just like it feels so arbitrary that you have to do this number of rak'ahs and you have to wash this many times. And of course people ascribe meaning later on and they say, oh, it's three times because of this. And I remember reading that in Muslimish, we read Jonathan Haidt's chapter in his book, The Righteous Mind. And he actually talked about like how things being arbitrary can increase someone's faith in something because it's irrational. I don't know if that's a fair summary, Zora.
Well, I think it was like the work. Well, it's like the work that you have to do to rationalize that irrational thing is what helps. I think that's
But didn't it start out that the prophet said that God asked people to pray 50 times and then the prophet went back and kind of was negotiating with him and brought it down to 5 times so that it could actually
but
be
even
doable?
Five. So that story is definitely, it was prominent in my upbringing too, but like I feel like no matter what number you arrive at, it's an arbitrary number.
Yeah, I mean, can I jump in, not so much as a host here, but as a participant, and say something about my experience?
Please do.
Sure.
I'm going to have to admit that I don't know how to pray. I was never taught how to pray because I grew up in an extremely secular household. Nobody prayed. But I think for me, the ritual, the most meditative thing for me to do was poetry or was reading. And that's where I feel that the experiences that you guys are describing, that is when I am really uptight or when I am emotionally distressed, there are certain passages of certain novels that I go to and that I read repeatedly, and they give me unbelievable comfort. Now, they're not connected to any sense of reward. They're just a reward in themselves. So I just wanted to throw that in, you know, but to me, that was a meditative space.
Yeah, I think it like begs the question of like what could be different if you choose what you are saying, if you choose things that are meaningful for you to recite versus something that someone else has told you to recite.
The one thing I was going to bring up, I had actually two questions. One thing was, so Janine, you never like had to pray like in a group or something setting? Did you?
No. Well, I mean, there were a couple of times where we were in situations where it was kind of embarrassing, and my dad would literally like coach us and say, just watch what everybody's doing. When they do the sujood, just do it mechanically. But it was like just to make sure that we didn't make,
that's
like
hilarious.
We weren't scandalous. But it was like, watch what they're doing. And if they bend down, bend down. And if they get up, get up, and don't make it too obvious. And that was like the thing, things
I
of that
this.
Nature.
Hmm. I was going to that's really funny. So, but the one thing I was going to comment on, so this is at the previous podcast, I had brought up the thing about that prayer is very communal. And so even as I like manipulate things myself, I realize like you sort of, in Islam, it's like pretty bad if I started spreading that to people, because one of the pivotal aspect of prayer, as Wassam also talked about, is the communal aspect, and people are brought together. And so that means that it sort of unfortunately has to be this very simplistic thing as for lots of people to sort of do it. So there seems like there's this trade-off. Like one is, if you want to get lots of groups of people together, you want to have this mechanical, maybe more mechanical, more simplistic form. Or as Nura was sort of alluding to, is if you wanted to like have it be fit for each individual person, then maybe the reach of it would be less. I don't know what you guys think about that.
No, I think that's a really good point. That, I mean, Islam also likes to represent itself as a religion that's easy, that doesn't put too many hardships. And so the fact, and Wissam was talking about this, that it's mechanical means that large groups of people can do it. And I think one of its functions is to kind of consolidate that feeling of belonging, that bonding. You know, when everybody is doing exactly the same motions in the same way, reciting the very same words, because that's a salat as opposed to the dua, you know, the supplication, which can become more personal. I think that it really does have this function of binding people together. And the fact,
exactly.
You know, the fact that it can be simplified and the fact that it can be standardized, maybe is the word, is really important.
Yes, there's also an aspect that maybe, you know, you haven't maybe seen before, that I've experienced when I came as a teenager into, you know, first we went to Canada first. So, you know, when we first immigrated, I was thinking, okay, now we're starting a new life, and I was having different expectations that were based on what we've seen from Hollywood and from the different American shows that we used to see in the Middle East. Then we came to high school, and then, you know, we didn't find those expectations. There was not a very easy integration or assimilation of us. There were a lot of anti-immigrant sentiments. There were racism. There were just a clash of culture, a cultural shock too. So that actually made me and many of my friends actually resort back to religion for identity and for strength. So we became more religious, and prayer in those instances became a form of resistance.
Really?
So it became like it's our type of gang. This is our gang activity, and this is, you know, this is our solidarity. This is what we do together, and this is what makes us strong and united together. So it took a form where it became a cool thing, where you know, younger Muslims in the school, they wanted to join us because it just looks cool and we're strong and we're growing in number and it's peaceful. And, you know, this is what their grandmas and parents, they did back home. And it brought some sort of, you know, nostalgia and heritage. So prayer in that sense is something else.
Well, Wissam, did you then, were you in a public school and you'd actually take the time out? And was there a place for you guys to pray in the school? How did this play out?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we would go, we met with the principal. We, you know, we want to have our prayer spot. And they would, you know, they're very accommodating. So they'd arrange for you. You know, part of freedom of expression is students have the freedom to express their religiosity. And the school accommodated us and we grew in numbers. And even when there was a fight or something, like I'm telling you, it took a form. It's the same sociology as any tribe or group. So it became an identity. Even those who are not religious, they identified with the group who were Muslim.
And how many times a day would you pray in school?
I mean, it would only one prayer would be during the school, which is dhuhr.
Okay. And it was done on a daily basis? They'd let the kids leave the classroom and go to pray?
Yeah, you'd have a pass, and it's practiced widely today in all schools of America. Muslims do take time out to pray in most of the schools.
But is that not a violation of separation of church and state? I mean, do other religious groups take time out to pray during the day?
Not usually. I mean, so there are students have the freedom to practice their religion and to express their religion during school, as long as it is not substantially disruptive to the educational environment.
Interesting.
And the administration should not do anything that encourage or discourage any type of practice. As long as the administration is neutral in public schools, then the separation of church and state holds.
Would you miss anything from the material while you were praying, or would the teacher pause while people left the class?
No, you would miss about 10 minutes. Important. Definitely, yes. So there was no hesitation about that. And it became an identity. So, and then, you know, when I went to college, I want to talk about, and I'm sure a lot of Muslimish, they experienced that. So I feel that the way prayer was designed, it's very Eastern and very relative to its time. And I know there are some scholars that try to make it more flexible, but mainstream Islam, you have to pray these five prayers. They have very rigid intervals of time, and you should not miss prayer. I mean, you know, there is a prayer for the sick person. There is a prayer that, you know, if you cannot move, you're in pain and you cannot move your body, you pray with your head. And if you can't even move your head, you pray with your eyes. And there is a prayer for the mujahid, even the person who is fighting. In the middle of the fight, there is a special prayer for him. This is how strict is the practice of prayer, that there is no excuse whatsoever for a person to leave prayer.
Even if you are physically unable to do it and prostrate and do the movements, you can do it sitting down. And if you can't move at all, you do it with your eyes. Okay. So it's very
obvious. If you can't do it with your eyes, you do it with your heart.
Right. So it's a real obligation. It's a real duty that cannot be ignored, is what you're
very
saying.
Very much. And if you cannot do wudu, you do tayammum. You know, you do with sand. There's a form of substitute. So wudu is a form of a spiritual purification using water. And then if you can't do it with water, there is another form of that you do it with sand. And if you can't do it, then you do it without water nor sand. And I can't tell you, if I write stories, I can write books about the complications of doing that, performing. And I'm sure Muslims who practice prayer, they all have similar stories. How do you practice this physically demanding ritual with it is prerequisites, which you have also have to do wudu.
Explain that. Wudu is washing
your hands and face and wiping your head and feet. That's the wudu, basically. You have to do that before a prayer. It's some sort of a ritual that makes you spiritually pure, and then it gets impured. You get back to an impure state if you use the bathroom, or if you let out gas, or if you sleep, or if you get unconscious, or if you perform a sexual act. So these are the things that make you break the scope, breaking the wudu, and then you have to redo the wudu. Of course, the most annoying one is the letting go of gas. And then once you get back to the pure situation, you can perform the prayer. It's a prerequisite for prayer, and your wudu will remain intact if you don't do any of these five things until your next prayer, and you can perform your next prayer with wudu.
To me, this strikes me as somebody who never had to pray and who was never obliged and never actually did it. It just seems to me that if you are praying five times a day, and every time you pray, you have to make sure that you're in a pure state, that you've done the ritual of washing yourself. It would seem to me like you're living a life where throughout your daily life, you are never allowed to forget your identity as a Muslim. It is a constant reaffirmation of it.
But it's also your connection to God, right? Or to Allah.
Yeah, but you know, it is, yani, it is too mechanical and physical and disruptive to the daily flow. If you are not living in Abu Dhabi, if you're not living in Cairo, it is very disruptive to the daily flow. If you're living in a Western country with a natural flow, I mean, imagine you're going to university. In the Middle East, everything is made with that in mind. Everything surrounds, you know, the prayer, the prayer times, they're taken into consideration in everything. So it's smooth and easy. But with an international, you know, with an international mind, if religion is going to get out of borders and be an international phenomena among 3,600 religions that are registered in the United Nations, and people have different religions, it just seems unpractical. It seems like if you're looking at different religions, and of course I don't have a survey of all religions and the rituals, but it seems Islam is one of the harshest ones in terms of rituals. For you have to pray this, and you'll see this. You'll see pictures of this. You'll see Muslims praying in the most awkward places, and I've had challenges praying in different places during interviews, during day of heavy testing at university. I used to have a spot in one of the universities where I go up to the third floor, and there's like a quiet place that I used to pray at, kind of like at the door of the roof. And the door was locked, but that small space was an empty space for me to pray. So I used to go there and pray until there are a couple lovers that took over that place. And every time I go up, they're sitting there and making out, and I have to go and find another place. which was very
it solidified your need to pray. So you're like, please, Allah, protect me from this.
Yeah, it's like, you know, this is like a pure place for me, you know, and now it's only known for two things: prayer and making out.
I'd like to talk also about the different kind of prayer, the supplication, the dua, because I'm really interested in that. The dua, for example, I think is a prayer that seems to be a supplication that's not as ritualized and that you can do in a, on a more personal basis, is if you want something from God. Or and also it seems to me that, like, for example, the dua of a mother is very, very strong, because the mother has a very central place in Islam. So if a mother is doing a dua that's positive for her children, it's assumed to have a lot of power. And so I think it gives the person who's pronouncing the dua a certain kind of power in society. Did you ever have experiences with that, with the mother saying, I'm going to do a dua for you?
Yeah, I mean, the subject of dua is really, Jinan deserves an episode by itself. And I have a very interesting discussion about that, because I had some sort of a revolution within my understanding of dua very early on, in the midst of my Islamic studies. So I'd like to reserve it to a separate episode, perhaps.
Okay, maybe next week. The week following that too.
There's one thing I'd like to add, if the time allows, Jinan.
We've got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, so I just want to recap an impression that I have positive experiences of you know, mystical experiences through especially Salat al-Layl, the recommended prayer. Now forget about the obligatory prayer, the recommended prayer, the prayer that you volunteer to do at night, where you are alone and you are dedicating that focus and contemplation on what you perceive as the creator of the universe and the all-powerful. And you're having this private conversation that is full of love and intimacy and passion. It's an amazing experience, amazing mystical experience. It's probably close to what meditation calls enlightenment, or Buddhists call nirvana. Or I'm sure there was a high level of dopamine released in my body. I was addicted to it, and it was a beautiful experience. That's of course subjective. So this is my experience is one of the spectrum of the experiences within Muslimish. At the same time, I've had a lot of difficulties dealing with the mechanical aspects of Salat on a daily basis, especially in my working day or in my studying days, that I felt it's kind of impractical in the West, in the way it is, like five prayers, all that. It's demanding. It's about an hour to 2 hours a day of ritualized practice. And so that is a negative experience for me. The positive experience is that mystical at night voluntary prayer. But in general, whatever our journey takes us to, whether if a person has I have a lot of friends who have questioned Islam. I have friends who have questioned Islam and they have left Islam. So if a person leaves Islam, it doesn't mean that they had a negative experience with prayer. It doesn't mean that they hate prayer.
I think Nora had a slightly less positive experience with prayer, or at least certain aspects of it. If we could, if she could perhaps jump in right here so that we get a different perspective.
Yeah. Sorry, I was muting myself. But I see the point that Wissam is making, that each person has different experiences and that prayer could be positive. But yeah, I mean, I don't think I necessarily, I think I had positive experiences here and there. But generally, not that I had a tremendously negative experience with it, but that I saw that it was not a voluntary activity, and the fact that it was not voluntary, I saw people around me being punished for not praying in very severe ways. And it took away any sense of agency for me when I thought about prayer. It just felt like something that was forced upon me, and something that, it felt like a ritual that I didn't want to partake in, but that felt necessary anyway. And I really, really tried, I think, as I was questioning Islam, to like seek some sort of guidance from God in moments of prayer. That was actually my father's recommendation to me. He said, like, have you been praying? And I said, no, I stopped. And he said, well, try and see if you can reconnect with God, because I'm sure that God wants to guide you right now. And so I really, really tried to make something that was ritualistic more. I was almost making dua during my prayer, and I was sort of like sending all of my thoughts to God and asking him to please guide me. And I felt nothing. And I think this is not my sole experience, but many people experience this. So if I can be that person on the podcast who can present that prayer was not all rosy, it definitely wasn't rosy. I saw my sister being like severely punished when she didn't pray. I saw the way that it was enforced in school, and it just wasn't, it
How
wasn't
was it enforced
experience.
In school? Can you describe that a little bit?
It was just part of the school schedule, and there would be teachers who would stand at the back of the hall to watch us while we prayed. And so when we would do sajda or we would do a rak'ah, you know, they would make sure that we were looking ahead of us, that we weren't talking to each other, even though students did anyway. You know, when they would go down for sajda, they would turn their heads to each other and laugh or tell jokes or whisper things to each other. But it became something that was like being overseen, and it was, yeah. So all of these aspects of like a connection with God, they were all like muddled down, like, or watered down, and became sort of this like this requirement that you just have to do it in this specific way.
So it became like an empty ritual. It no longer had.
Even though my father said a lot of like, but you need to like think about the meanings of the words that you're saying. You need to be contemplative during that ritual. It's just, I think it's a constant balance that I was trying to strike between like finding meaning in it for myself and also realizing that it's not something that I chose or designed or created for myself to do.
Very interesting. Zarar, do you have anything to add to that?
I had two things to say. The first was to add that for me, like as I grew up, one interesting thing that I found was that like looking towards the Eastern traditions, like in Hinduism and Buddhism, it was just really amazing, like how many different forms of prayer. In that case, it's not ritual. It's not like the Muslim ritual, but there's so many different forms of meditation or different forms of prayer. And depending on the kind of person you are, so we already mentioned loving kindness meditation, the breathing meditation. I don't know. I was just mentioning that sort of, as I grew older, that was really interesting to find other traditions. So one thing I was going to add, this is totally not on topic, necessarily related to what we're talking about right now, but I actually like haven't, so I started praying maybe like a year and a half or 2 years ago, and like I haven't told my parents. And so if I go home, I so I pray what's the equivalent of Fajr, but when I get up, I don't actually pray Fajr at the right time, but I pray Fajr and then Isha. I pray, but also not at the right time. I just pray right before I go to sleep. But so I'll be at home and I'll like sneak into my parents' like closet and I'll get the jainamaz, which is just the prayer mat. And like I'll sneak into my room and I'll like pray. Then I'll go back and sneak it back.
You don't want your parents to know that you're doing this.
Yeah, it's really funny. And I think it might relate to this aspect that we were talking about, that prayer is important to be more Muslim. Like if you don't pray, it's really the equivalent of not being very Muslim. And so I feel like my parents just think I'm like, I don't know if they think I'm not an atheist, but I think they think I'm more along those lines of agnosticism and atheism. And so like maintaining that status quo just feels sort of easier than to somehow explain. Whereas I guess that's why I feel comfortable in Muslimish, because my viewpoints aren't necessarily, can't be categorized one way. So they might see me praying and say, oh my God, he's now Muslim and stuff. Whereas it's not exactly that simple.
Can you tell us what you're reciting now that you are going back to praying? Because that's really interesting. You talked about that a little bit to me.
what I was reciting. So I do sort of the Fatiha all the time. It's funny that people mentioned, we were both with Sam and Noura mentioning the obligatoriness of that surah. So I always say that first. And then there's two things I've been, and then afterwards, so sorry, I'll back up again. So in each rak'ah of the prayer that we have sort of the Fatiha first. And then if it's the first two rak'ahs, the next one is some other surah. So one thing I started doing, but recently I've stopped because it's so hard to do, was I was trying to memorize other things. So normally you're supposed to memorize some other surah and repeat it back. So I thought, well, I don't really understand these surahs, so maybe I should try something else. So one thing I was trying was the Gospels, which is a funny text to choose. But I actually really like the Gospels. I think, like, I've been meaning to actually suggest it for a book club even, because some of what Jesus says is actually very topical to Muslims, because he's, you know, Jesus is like referring against like a lot of Jewish ritual practices. For instance, he says like the Sabbath was, man wasn't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man, indicating that, you know, these sort of rituals were made for us. We weren't sort of tailored for them.
So wait, I'm understanding, you're taking the Gospels and you're incorporating them into the Muslim prayer.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so one thing I memorized.
That's really interesting. It's a way of kind of reclaiming that the ritual is for us. We're not for the ritual. Like, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. But it's still keeping the point of it. I think for a lot of Muslims, I interestingly had a discussion about this with Noura's dad.
I'm so sorry about that.
I wasn't sure how much I should say to him. So I definitely didn't say the black hole thing, but I sort of mentioned that I was doing this. I just was intrigued to see what a Muslim would say to me. I think he was very aghast by it. And he was saying, you know, this is not for prayer. It should be more a dua thing. But for me, it was like, and I tried to explain this to him, but I feel like we're talking on different levels where I'm like, there's a purpose for something. So the purpose of the ayah is for you to say something that's meaningful, like morally and sort of to you. And so that's what I feel like. So if I'm using the Gospels, it fulfills the same purpose. It's just not the Quran. But
That was such a fascinating conversation to witness, because it was sort of, you were speaking at very different frequencies. And just like, my father was looking, I think he was looking for the key words, like, I do a raka, I do this prayer. I could sort of see, my mother was there too, I could sort of see them trying to categorize Zarar as he was speaking. Like, oh yes, he's still, oh no, he's not Muslim. Oh yes, he's still Muslim. And it was just.
You know what? And that makes people, and that brings us back again, Noura, to the idea of when you have a standardized prayer where everybody knows the exact motions and the surahs that you are supposed to recite, then it kind of consolidates the sense that we all have a particular identity. Whereas when you start to use those motions and incorporate the Gospels, then the idea of who you are, that you have this recognizable identity, that everybody does the same thing, kind of goes away, and it becomes confusing to people because, well, wait a second, he's doing the rak'ah, but he's using the Gospel instead. So what is he? Is he a Muslim? Is he a Christian? Is he out of his mind? So I think that is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, just on a personal level for me, like, again, it's so hard to memorize things. So I haven't been doing it recently. One thing is, as you memorize, it's actually meditative to memorize things. And then in the case of the Gospels, because, you know, again, I don't speak Arabic, so it's all in English. When I repeat it back, I it has much more meaning to me. Like, say, there's like the one that I first memorized was, do not judge. There's like a famous passage in the Gospel saying, do not judge, for you too will be judged. Like, in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And so as I say that, I also visualize to myself, like, not judging other people. And then there's a next part that says, you know, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother or sister's eye and not pay attention to the plank in your own eye? And it says some other things. And it says, you hypocrite, first, you know, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you shall see clearly to remove the speck from your brother or sister's eye. So for me, doing that, because it's in English, I can visualize it. It has more meaning to me.
Can I perhaps conclude with one question. Given that, you know, in the United States, and you have a lot of people who, like Zarar, don't speak Arabic, and, you know, you're going to have second, third generation descendants of Arabic speakers who may no longer speak Arabic. Do you guys visualize a time when people will start to wonder whether the ritualized salat can actually be performed in other languages, like if the surahs of the Quran can actually be recited in English rather than in Arabic? Are these kinds of discussions, Wissam, perhaps already happening in mosques?
Yeah, already Reform Muslims already do that. Actually, it is, you know, there is flexibility, especially ala madhab Abu Hanifa. Abi Hanifa, there is flexibility in that, and already some progressive Muslims are doing that. They're doing prayers in English.
But does it have the same, like the English translations don't just feel as the same?
Right, but you know, that's, it's happening. People are using a translation, you know, just English. They're doing prayers in English completely. Yeah. Progressive Islam hasn't really picked up. It has been active in the United States for the last 50 years, but it hasn't really picked up, which is interesting. Reform Islam is still also not picking up the pace, although right now we're seeing a lot of fast-paced changes in the Islamic world, so we'll see what's going to happen.
It's going to be very interesting to see how these ritualized forms are adapted and how they evolve and change. But really, this has been a very, very interesting and fascinating discussion. I'm really would like to thank all of my guests today, Wissam Sharafuddin, Noura Imbabi, and Zarar Shahzad. And I'm hoping that we will have yet another episode on Dua, the prayer of supplication. Again, if you enjoyed our podcast, please check out our website, muslimish.org. And if we would like to listen to more of our podcasts, you can go to Patreon, our Patreon page, .com/muslimish. And thank you all for being here with us tonight, and have a good night.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.